Welcome back. Up next, the spokesperson for Russia's foreign ministry, Maria Zakharova, held her weekly press conference Thursday, and we bring you that in its entirety.
Good afternoon. So traditionally, I'll start the briefing with Minister Lavrov's schedule. We have already announced that the minister will take part in the Munich Security Conference. We have received a lot of questions regarding his bilateral meetings that are planned for the margins of this conference. We have already talked about some of those meetings, and now I can confirm that there are some meetings planned on the sidelines of this conference with his counterparts from Japan, with the Secretary General of the OSCE, his colleagues from Spain, as well as minister is planning to hold talks with his colleagues from Egypt, Ukraine, Germany, and I will talk in more detail about this meeting later. We cannot confirm, but we're working on it. A meeting in the Normandy Quartet, and there are some meetings planned with the Secretary General of NATO, as well as with Foreign Minister of Slovakia, who is the president of the 72nd General Assembly session, as well as with his counterparts from Moldova and Croatia. So we'll inform you later about some additional meetings. The minister's speech will be dedicated to the perspectives of Russia-EU relations. I have already mentioned, I will talk a little bit more about the minister's meetings with representatives of the German and Russian business community, as well as with the foreign minister of Germany. We have already announced this meeting. It is not a multilateral international meeting, but it has become a very good tradition on the margins of the Munich Security Conference, where minister meets with representatives of the business communities of our countries. It will take place on the 17th of February, and it will also bring together Mr. Gabriel, who is Vice Chancellor of Germany, and also the Foreign Minister of Germany. Well, ministers will talk about commercial and investment cooperation against the background of political risks and economic sanctions. They will talk about the improvement on investment climate in our country. I can also announce a series of other events. On the 18th and 19th of February, on the invitation of the Russian foreign minister, foreign minister of People's Democratic Republic of Algeria will visit Moscow, and he will also hold talks with other representatives of Russian government, as well as with the representative of the Russian Security Council. Algeria is one of the leading partners of Russia in Africa and the Islamic world. We have many common policies and visions in foreign policy. We believe it is necessary to respect international law, to base our work on the central role of the United Nations, and to ensure that people have a right for self-determination. We have very common visions on the situation in Syria and Libya. We have worked hard in order to forge mutually beneficial relations between our countries in different areas, including military and technical cooperation, energy, as well as humanitarian and cultural exchanges. The turnover has been exceeded exceeding $3 billion for several years already. And during the visit of Russia's Prime Minister Medvedev in Algeria, we have worked out a comprehensive program for future cooperation, including in scientific areas, in nuclear energy and other. Another testament to our wish to improve our relations is the work of Intergovernmental Commission between Algeria and Russia. We have created good foundations in order to improve our relations. On the 20th of February, the Pakistani foreign minister will visit Moscow on the invitation of Minister Lavrov. They plan to address the current state as well as the perspective for bilateral cooperation, as well as to exchange their views on international and regional agenda. This year, we're marking the 17th anniversary of diplomatic relations between our countries, and the cooperation with Pakistan is one of the priorities for the Russian Federation. We are maintaining an intense political dialogue, as well as the constructive cooperation at the international forums, the United Nations, for example. And since Pakistan has exceeded the Shanghai Organization for Cooperation as a full-fledged member, we have been new possibilities open up for our cooperation. We plan to increase and enhance our cooperation in commerce and economy, as well as to fight with terrorism. On the 20th of February, in Diplomatic Academy of the Russian Foreign Minister, it will host a conference dedicated to the memory the Ambassador Churkin, and it will bring together participants who will share the memories of Mr. Churkin. Minister Lavrov will attend this meeting, as well as the directors of the foreign minister and ambassadors of foreign countries accredited to Russia, as well as the representative of academia, as well as the journalists and Russian diplomats. So you're welcome to get accredited to this event. And I can assure you that it will be very substantial and informative and very interesting. And apart from sharing the memories of his professional activities, we will share memories about his personal private life. On the 21st of February, Minister Lavrov will visit the Republic of Slovenia. He is scheduled to have a meeting with the President Pahor, as well as with the Vice Prime Minister and Foreign Minister. They plan to address the current state as well as the perspective for bilateral cooperation, as well as the opportunities to enhance the cooperation in political, trade, and economical areas. And now, since in the city of Maribor has been opened the International Research Center of the Second World War, we have opened up new possibilities for us. We plan to exchange our views on different issues of Balkan and European agenda. On the 21st, 22nd of February, Minister Lavrov will visit the Republic of Serbia. It marks the 180th anniversary of diplomatic relations between our countries. It is scheduled that the minister will meet the president of Serbia, as well as the first Vice Prime Minister of Serbia, and minister will attend to the presentation of the mosaic decorations of the dome of the Cathedral of St. Sava in Belgrade, and Minister Lavrov will also give a talk for the students of the Belgrade University. It is planned that ministers will address our bilateral cooperation, as well as the perspective for joint projects and exchange views on issues of Balkan and international agenda. Okay, and I would like to go back to the 180th anniversary of relations between Russia and Serbia. So on the 19th of February in the building of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs here, in building number one, the Foreign Minister Lavrov an opening of an exhibition dedicated to this event. The exhibition brings together copies of important diplomatic documents since the establishment of diplomatic relations between a country in 1838 and up to the visit by the President of Serbia that took place in December of 2017. This exhibition is another proof that our people share common affection that is founded on common memories. Okay, and now I would like to go to the international agenda. Well, first of all, I would like to express gratitude for the compassion that people all over the world, starting from the heads of state and to the common folk, have expressed in relation to the tragedy that took place on the 11th of February in the Moscow region. I'm talking about the N-148 plane crashing. Russia has received messages from dozens of heads of different states, as well as the heads of different international organizations and ambassadors, as well as many religious leaders, and in many countries, just common folk came to the embassies of the Russian Federation bringing flowers in order to express condolences. And I'd like to say that we are grateful to everyone who hasn't remained indifferent to this tragedy and express their condolences and their support. And now I would like to go to the situation in Syria. The political life in Syria over the last week has been guided by the outcomes of the Syrian National Dialogue Congress. Well, I would like to remind you that it took place on the 29th, 30th January in Sochi. It brought together representatives of different political forces and civil society, as well as ethno-confessional groups. They called for the unity of the country and transition to the peace life based on the principles of that have been agreed upon in order to renew the state system. That was the message that those participants sent to the international community. Well, however, some attempts from external forces don't go in line with this message. And the de facto occupation by the U.S. military is maintained. I'm talking about the 55 kilometers around Tanfa that has become a safe zone for ISIS members that have not been finished off yet. Well, another provocative actions we witnessed in On the other shore of the Euphrates, where U.S. military has been almost openly confronting Syrian army. Provoking Turkey, the United States have been sending convoys with armaments through the territory of Iraq, while Turkey has been continuing its operation that is called the Olive Branch. And the fights have been very intense and fierce. Terrorists of Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, that is ex-Jabhat al-Nusra, have been carrying out aggressive provocations on the west of the de-escalation zone, killing innocent people in mortar shelling. Though well aware of that, many Western countries have been quite compassionate with those people, presenting them almost as some fighters with what they call the bloody regime in Syria. They probably have don't remember that so many people in the ranks of the UNNUSRA are not Syrians. Some time ago, the leader of the group, Abu Mehmet al-Julani, said that those non-Syrians accounted for 40% of Jabhat al-Nusra. Though this lack of memory sometimes can be useful because it is much easier to muddy the waters, unfoundedly accusing Syrian army as well as the Russian air forces in unprovoked IS strikes and violence escalation. Under the strikes by the Syrian military, ISIS militants were driven out of the Idlib province, and about 350 ISIS members surrendered to the Syrian armed opposition. We know nothing of their destiny. There is some information on the ISIS websites that they have been killed, but it is questionable. The most important thing is ensure that they do not join the ranks of other terrorist organizations. Now, the United States has been very vocal about the so-called imprisoned ISIS, in particular the head of Pentagon, Mr. Mattis. While in Rome, meeting with anti-ISIS coalition, he said that jihadists should not be contained in Syria because due to the continuing instability, they can be liberated. However, the United States has not made any other concrete proposals on what as whether what to do with those people, because there are some countries that are not happy to see those ex-terrorists back in their countries. We will keep a close eye on this situation, and it is necessary to say that those people that committed crimes are criminally responsible under this or this particular country jurisdiction. And so here arises a question. So can international terrorists be given a status of extraterritoriality? Another topic that I would like to address is allegedly the American airstrike has allegedly killed Russian military. We have seen such information in different media, CNN, New York Times, Washington Post, among others, and I'm quoting here that many Russian military have been killed by the U.S. airstrikes in Deir ez-Zor. Bloomberg says that there have been 200 people. Some other media saying that there have been more than 100. And New York Times saying that we're talking about dozens of killed militants. Well, one curious thing is that even before this information was published in the media, the anti-governmental Syrian militants published this information in their media, using the images of Mars surface, using some other images of Ukrainian military equipment. Well, we're talking about a classical example of misinformation. According to some preliminary data, due to an open confrontation, we're talking about five persons being killed who are supposedly are Russian citizens. There are people injured, but yet all this information has to be double-checked, and we need to make sure what the citizenship of those people are. And I would like to emphasize one more time that we're not talking about Russian military contingent. So it is quite obvious others why terrorists are trying to distribute this kind of information, and why Americans are doing this is quite evident too. I believe that it has been the American initiative that have been accusing the Russian Federation in meddling in their internal affairs, including during the presidential elections through social networks. Well, probably the United States should say and inform the public on the number of American citizens that died in Iraq during their campaign there, and I'm sure that many will be shocked by this number, so it's better stick to your business and do not disinform other people. And I would like also to emphasize that in the President Putin's administration, as well as the Ministry of Defense, have stated that there were no Russian military contingent in the area of American airstrike. Another topic that I would like to draw your attention to is that in the conflict zones there are a lot of people from all over the world, including Russia and other countries, other bordering countries. Some of them are there to take part in hostile activities. And, well, as you can understand quite easily, those people who are willing to take part in hostilities do not get there illegally, so it is quite difficult to track all of them. Well, however, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, as well as other governmental bodies, are working on each case, because to protect Russian citizens abroad is one of our priorities. Each Russian citizen has a right to be protected by the state, even if this person violates the Russian law. And I would like to emphasize one more time that we're talking about the conflict zone, where people are witnessing hostilities and violent activities. And our diplomats are doing all they can, and those biased articles are only making their work much more difficult. Another thing that I would like to say about Syria is the press release by Technical Secretary to the OPCW about the fact-finding mission in Syria. And the FFM has started to investigate different sources on the use of toxic chemicals in the East Ghouta and Idlib provinces in January. Well, according to the documents, they are looking into the materials from open sources, as well as they are conducting interviews with the witnesses, studying medical records and other sample analysis. Well, in other words, they are continuing their remote investigations. So there is one thing that we need to understand, that we cannot take at face value statements by interested parties like Syrian opposition and affiliated NGO. The only way to find out the truth is to collect evidence on the impact sites, because it is otherwise it is impossible to find who has used the arms and how. The representatives of Jaish al-Islam group have said they were ready to grant an access to the FFM professionals to the regions of Karmaras and other regions, and to ensure their security at those sites. Well, we hope that OPCW experts will stop trying to investigate this incident remotely and will visit the impact sites and will collect samples necessary for this investigation. And concluding the topic, we also made notice of the statements made by the press service of the State Department of the U.S. Regarding the fact that the U.S. in Syria is for two reasons. The first one is to destroy the ISIS and to stabilize the situation in the country. I'd like to draw attention to the fact that a few months ago it was only one reason, the presence of the U.S. in the territory of the sovereign state of Syria, namely the fight against the ISIS. Some months passed, and now there are two reasons. In essence, the actions of the U.S. raise a lot of questions, and these actions are undertaken without the invitation of the legitimate Syrian government, without any sanctions of UN Security Council sanctions. Nevertheless, for the interests of fighting terrorism, Russia decided to come to terms with the U.S. servicemen, because we had been told that the only reason for staying there of the U.S. coalition is fighting the ISIS. And this very structure of the ISIS had been destroyed, but now, and now and then, our U.S. colleagues present other explanations, and they say that this process should be ended by the transition, by the change of the regime. Now the Americans try to play the Kurdish card, and they pursue the unilateral interests that are aimed at undermining the stability in Syria rather than strengthening the regime. Now we'd like to focus on the fact that their words really and their statements really differ. They are different. We haven't received any answers to our anxieties that we voice during our meetings and publicly. First, we need to do it publicly because we do not get any response. As for these discrepancies, our American colleagues usually attack us and blame us for escalating the violence in Syria and for making a great deal of victims there, and for citing the accusations against Damascus on the use of chemical weapons. I do not rule out that these pieces of news are also connected to the topic, and we would like to remind you once again that the settlement of the situation in Syria should be in line with the resolution 2254 of this UN Security Council, and we need to normalize the situation in line with the process started in Sochi by the Congress of the National Dialogue. And its statement was published in the available resources of our ministry, and you can familiarize yourselves with this information once again. I'd like to go to other topics. On the 17th of February, it will be 120th anniversary of establishment of diplomatic relations between Russia and Ethiopia. And 1898, Russian head of the extraordinary mission, Mr. Vlasov, handed credential to the Emperor Menelik II. Now our relations are based on the traditions of friendship, a mutual respect and fruitful cooperation. Ethiopia is a very important partner of Russia in Africa, and we maintain a very intensive political dialogue based on
our similar perception of the things happening in the world, and we see great potential for enriching our cooperation in our trade and economic sphere, and also in the energy, including the nuclear energy and in different fields of the fundamental and applied science and education. And we expect to see an exchange of the messages between the foreign ministers of our countries, and Moscow and Addis Ababa will host a number of events coinciding with this event. And the Embassy of Russia in Addis Ababa will hold a solemn reception with the participation of the leadership of the Foreign Minister of Ethiopia and different public figures. Now we will go to the situation in Ukraine. I would like to say to speak about the anniversary of the Minsk agreement. As you know, it's the 3-year anniversary after the signing of the package of the Minsk agreement. Thanks to the document, we managed to avoid the escalation of the process and its dipping into the civilian war. A special roadmap was proposed, including different political steps. It was supposed that these measures could make us find a way to the conflict until 2015, but they didn't work that way. Instead of helping to implement Minsk agreements, they started to sabotage, to blur, and to block the negotiations process. Not even one of the points of the items of the package was implemented, and there are still shellings and conflicts in those territories, largely initiated by the Ukrainian authorities, and Kiev is still reluctant to maintain dialogue with the representatives of Donetsk and Luhansk. So they still wanted to implement this forceful solution in the occupied territories, which is confirmed by the approval of the law on reintegration of Donbass. So we still have a searing hotbed of tension, and Ukraine is bears total responsibility for that. Moscow is convinced that the Minsk agreements are the only basis and the only way to settle the Ukrainian crisis. The faster they will get to their realization, the sooner we will see the end of the conflict. We also commented the persecution of the executive editor of главного редактора этого издания Генеральная прокуратура Украины теперь заочно намерена ужесточить меру пресечения за залог на заключение под стражу. This Igor Gudja, this newscast, a news agency Strana UA, now this Lukashevich, the permanent representative of Russia to the OSCE, demanded a quick response regarding this situation. Measures against this journalist, Igor Gudja, is a sign of Ukrainians fighting against any dissent in the country. And on the 8th of April, Ukrainian security agencies came to search this office of the newspaper Vesti. So we see that the situation in Ukraine still denigrates, and this is with the support of the relevant law enforcement agencies. And up to now, up to the press release of the representative of the OSCE on the freedom of the media, this statement, this press release is still lacking. Previous time, we got a lot of questions with the request to assess the strategy of the EU regarding the Western Balkans.
We,
of course, paid a lot of attention to the documents and to your comments and to your questions. And on the 6th of February, the European Commission elaborated the strategy for the Western Balkans, and it stated the geopolitical task of strengthening the EU role in this region. And we have repeatedly stated that we had no inconveniences with that if these candidates to enter the EU are not faced with the artificial choice, are you with the EU or with Russia. So when candidates are made to join the restrictions and sanctions against their will, we hope that the European Union will draw the conclusion out of this deplorable experience of the projects of the Eastern Partnership. And it seems that in spite of this importance of such criteria for the candidates, the main motive of the strategy was that the Euro candidates needed to meet the deadlines. And this is the fact that we need to actually deny this practice of prodding and fitting into some kind of criteria. We need to recover the situation in the Balkans and to restore stability and inter-ethnic harmony. This concerned these border issues and the state denomination relating to Macedonia. Nevertheless, the situation around and let alone the situation of these in Kosovo. We are convinced that we need to resolve the situation in Kosovo in line with the resolution 1244 of the UN Security Council. We cannot help but feel indignated with the comments expressed in European media, including in Euronews, on the strategy, and there were hints that that Montenegro had some advantages to join this bloc, and so they expressed the kind of understanding of how a candidate should enter the NATO alliance. I'd like to express share our comments on the 10th anniversary of the so-called declaration of the Kosovo statehood. Of course, this is a way to look into the inglorious outcome of this policy pursued by Pristina, and to give a legal status to the NATO aggression 1999. Of course, this aggression and secession didn't contribute to the principles of international law, and by the efforts of its benefactors, Kosovo has turned into another black hole with very strange and weird status. The hopes for unanimous and fast recognition by the international community didn't come true, and now there is an internal divide in the structure, and the practice of this pattern being applied in Kosovo didn't work, and now we have a precarious semi-puppet regime where decisions are made while dictated by the Western diplomats. Now, this situation is used for the placement of NATO infrastructure, contrary to the resolution 1244 of the UN Security Council, and we don't approve of the processes happening there. The unilateral declaration of independence didn't resolve the economic problems of that region, Now, Kosovo is still the poorest territory of the region, and there is rampant crime and corruption, and there is a conflict of clan-based interest, problems in the sphere of security, and great vulnerability to the terrorist threats from the Middle East. So we have a question. What should Pristina celebrate? And the drafters of this project do not have anything to make boast of. After this unilateral declaration of independence, I recall that in a lot of media outlets and in maybe it was in CNN. There was an advertisement, and the main slogan was that Kosovo is a land of opportunity. So you have this country now, and you have these opportunities. So at that time, I was interested who paid for such an advertisement in CNN. And you know that it is a very expensive thing. I would like also to comment on the visas issued here of American visas issued in Russia. This topic was commented by Независимая газета on the 9th of February. I would like to say that we are surprised by the way our American colleagues and representative of the U.S. Present this topic, the topic of issuing American visas in Russia. This is a deplorable, actually, situation, but we are not to blame for this because of many hostile actions and activities of Washington and sanctions and the seizure of our diplomatic missions. We had to downsize the personnel of U.S. missions here up to the level that we have the personnel there in the U.S. And we didn't dictate who was to be dismissed or downsized, but the American authority decided to downsize the visa section. So it was their own decision. As far as we understand, this was a political target for rousing the consent of the public by the Russian decision. So it was like an attempt to redirect this blow and to make it hit Moscow. As you know, that it is very hard to get American visa, and it has been long before that fact. About 15 years, the residents of the Russian regions have actually to go to Moscow, to St. Petersburg, Ekaterinburg, and Vladivostok to spend their money and time. Now, these EU missions radically decreased the scale of this work. Now they started to issue visas, but to a limited extent, and now this scale and level is three times lower than it was before, and the official term for waiting for the interviews is about 85 days, about 3 months, but it is still not observed because you cannot make an appointment at the official website. I would like to reiterate that it is the competence, the jurisdiction of the U.S., and you cannot blame Russia for that because it's absurd. This is an attempt to redirect the attention to somehow lay the fault at somebody else's door. And they said that Russia itself had created some obstacles by elevating the price for the visas for American citizens. Now, I would like to clarify that the U.S. citizens do not have any face any difficulties, and the Russian agreement on facilitating the visa issuance of 2011 doesn't have any fixed visa fees. So now, according to the legislation, the $90 for one single entry visa, $144 for double entry visas, and $270 for multiple visas. Actually, Americans prefer to obtain single entry visas because it's cheaper, and this differs from what Russian citizens pay for the American visas, $160 US dollars. It's very surprising that an issue was raised about the crews of Aeroflot and Russian athletes about the expedited issuance of their visas, because this is in line with the international obligation of the U.S. And last autumn, there was a situation that Aeroflot was not able to continue flying to the EU, to the United States, because the pilots didn't have a visa, appropriate visas, and our air transportation was endangered at that time.
From 1994 provides for the United States that have to issue visas to their air crews in timely manner. Well, there have been other similar problems for Russian sports athletes who had troubles getting into international competitions. Well, it seems that the United States have forgotten that when they are hosting some sport events, they have to grant an access to all the participants. It meaning that the non-issuing visas to Russian athletes can be considered a premeditated discrimination of the Russian Federation. And that's we have taken notice of that, and we had to indicate that. Well, of course, we are outraged seeing that due to American visa restrictions, many representatives of cultural community as well as just ordinary people have to cancel their travels. It looks like the United States is against Russian citizens traveling and entering their country. Well, probably they will bring some information, some truthful information about Russia to the United States. Probably afraid of that. And I'd like to say that 2 years ago, the State Department stripped off the accreditation of five of our representatives. They were trying to enhance contacts between our peoples. And we will tackle those issues during the ordinary regular consultations on consular issues. They were supposed to take place last year, however, the United States decided to delay them. If we see a wish to address those issues, so why do it in the media? We can do it face to face, so let's not try to join it. Let's try to address those issues immediately. Another topic that I would like to address it, the Second World War. In January, I have talked about the message of Mr. Dembski, who is director of the Polish Institute for International Relations. In his Twitter, he said that it was the Netherlands, not Poland, who was blocking the access of the Russian Federation to the participation in the International Managing Committee of the project of the new museum in Sobibor. We said that we had to double check this information. Well, according to the information that I have, the Netherlands authorities have been saying that that was not true. So who is lying? Are the Netherlands lying? So are the people from Poland lying? So is it so hard just to tell the truth? I would like to emphasize one more time that one of the Russian priorities is to be a full-fledged member of the project, because there were some prisoners from the USSR there, and under the leadership of the Russian military officer Pechorsky in October of 1943, they rebelled in Sobibor that was the only successful one during the Second World War. And there are many documents in the Russian archives that could enrich the exposition of that museum. And there is also one thing that I like to say. A lot of people say, so why do you need to participate in this project? So what's the big deal? We're living in an open information space, so when anything is published, you can get an access to it. So here is what can happen. On the 8th of February in Salus Peel Memorial Complex was held an opening of new exposition presenting a new version of the Salus Peel's history that has been promoted by the Latvian authorities. Well, according to Riga, Salus Peel has not been a death camp like Osvencim or Dachau. Well, allegedly that people didn't there due to violent reasons, but due to some illnesses or sicknesses, and the number of people that died there is underestimated. Well, according to those, according to archives, of about 53,000 people died in that camp. This exhibition focuses on so-called crimes by the Soviet and German occupation forces, and Latvia has nothing to do with that, and was just a hostage to those historical circumstances. And nothing is said about the Soviet soldiers that liberated Salus Peel. And, well, by the way, the Russian ambassador wasn't invited to that event. Well, the reasons are quite obvious. And nothing is said about the experiments on children that were carried out in that camp by the Nazis. And so this attempt to destroy this memory about violence in Salus Peel camp at the official level is an issue of a great concern, and it testifies to the fact that the falsification of history in Latvia is on the rise. So that's just, I wanted to say how everything is done now, how the history is being rewritten. I'd like to address some other topics. On the 8th of February, the Estonian intelligence published a document on this security in this country. So, well, this document is completely anti-Russian. It is quite evident. There is one thing that I would like to take to emphasize. Well, I have looked through the material on the topic, and well, according to the media, and well, I'd like to emphasize one more time, they're talking about the report on the security state in Estonia. So this document mentions Estonia only 37 times, while Russia is mentioned 458 times, well, and only as a threat to Estonian sovereignty. So it seems that if you just look at those figures that the threat is 10 times larger than the state. So it cannot but baffle us, because gives a lot of unfounded information about the alleged aggressiveness of its eastern neighbor. Well, it's a shame that instead of giving a balanced analysis, the authors of the document are offering just some anti-Russian cliché in a spy spirit. So are they calling for Estonians not to contact with the Russians? So maybe Russians should not travel to Estonia. Probably they are posing some kind of a threat to Estonian citizens. Well, it is some kind of intimidation of their own citizens, they're trying to intimidate those people who are trying to work productively and efficiently with their partners abroad. Okay, so here are some issues related to the information area on the 8th of February. Estonian service prohibited some channels by Russian or here due to supposedly violating some local laws. Well, taking into account this situation and taking account the same thing that happened to the NTV in Litva, well, we cannot but see that these words just are politically charged, and well, local authorities are trying to censor independent media. Repeatedly, this commission has stopped broadcasting RTR channel there and trying to move it to the channels on a payment basement. But the liberty of thought of expression means that everyone can express their opinion regardless of what the government likes or like not.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR, Community Public Radio. I'm your host, Don DeBar.